Just let me say how marvelous it is to have Glenn with us. Glenn's my absolute favorite academic expert on language testing. He wrote the superb Re-examining Language Testing, a Philosophical and Social Inquiry in 2012, which won the 2016 Sage ILT Book Award. It's an absolutely superb piece of work, a brilliant tour de force, and proof that language testing isn't, or at least doesn't have to be, boring. I should add that that book was joint winner of the prize, and the other winner was also by Glenn and Davidson, the 2012 Routledge Handbook of Language Testing. Fantastic reference work. So can I just say to everybody who's watching this or listening, they really must visit Glenn's fantastic website. Just Google Glenn Fulcher to find it. And say again how marvelous it is to have Glenn with us. So, Glenn, we, as you know, we're doing this course in task-based language teaching based on Mike Long's version. But before we get on to the more specific area of testing and assessment of TBLT in particular, I'd like to just ask you about your often quoted insistence of the importance of protecting test takers and test users from false results and poor decisions. And I wonder if you could just say a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. No problem at all. But first of all, thank you for the incredible introduction there, which I'm not entirely sure is all true. But at least I can give a compliment back, because you're my favorite writer on second language acquisition. And I still think your book is the best in the field. And we recommend it to the students on our programs all the time. So, however, to get to your first question, this issue of protecting people, we often talk about tests as either being low stakes or high stakes. And for people who don't know, haven't heard that term before, low stakes just means that when you get the results of a test, there isn't very much riding on it. So, you know, if teachers write classroom quizzes or something like that, they're using the results or the outcomes to inform the next step of teaching or learning. But no one's going to be disadvantaged or put at some disadvantage by anything that's going to be done. But with high-stakes tests, decisions are going to be made on the basis of the scores or the outcomes that really make a difference. And so we then say, well, to whom might this make a difference? And this could be individuals, it could be institutions, or it could be society at large. So let's, if we have poor false results or poor decisions, well, false results first. There are two kinds of false results. There are false positives. In other words, someone could pass a, you know, we could say they've passed a test or they've got a score above some kind of cut score, but they can't actually do what we think they should be able to do. Now, obvious examples here are things like tests of English for pilots or air traffic controllers. If we say, yes, they are able to successfully communicate between air traffic control and pilots, and they can't, then we have made a poor decision, which is likely to put people's lives at risk. And that's a case of making very poor decisions. And so who are we protecting here? Well, we're protecting the traveling public. We're protecting society at large. And I certainly wouldn't want to be on a plane piloted by someone who couldn't adequately communicate with air traffic control. Let's take another example, though. We might think that the kinds of tests that our students take, and we decide whether or not they can take up a place at university. We might think that's kind of low stakes, but perhaps not. And we're making this, you know, during the, you know, we're all in lockdown during the COVID-19 crisis. And universities are absolutely terrified at the moment of losing money because international students aren't going to turn up at the university. So what they're doing across the board, this is not just my university, all universities, is starting to say, well, perhaps we should lower the cut scores on IELTS and TOEFL so that we'll get more students and we will increase the number of entry points for those students. What are the risks there? Well, first of all, the likelihood is that we will get more false positives, and that once the students arrive, they will struggle with their academic courses, and the likelihood is that we will have a higher failure rate. Now, if that's the case, we are failing to protect the individuals, and so we've got an issue of whether or not making these decisions is ethical, even though it is seen as a financial imperative. But we've also got an issue of protection of the institution. If that decision is made, and if large numbers of students then fail, what will be the consequences for the institution in a year or 2 years' time? So, for all of these cases, we ask the question, if we make poor decisions, what are the consequences for individuals, institutions, and society? What are the ethical issues and what are the policy issues? So language testing goes far beyond just the issue of how do we structure the test, how do we give the scores, and so on. Now, just to finish off, I said false positives. We can also have false negatives. And that is, you know, we can have people who fail who should have passed. How many false negatives and positives we are prepared to tolerate depends on the risks associated with the poor decision making. But no test is 100% valid for its purpose or 100% reliable. And therefore, there's always an element of human judgment in this. But it goes well beyond just the issue of the design of the test. Does that answer the question?
Yes, yes. I actually allude to this a little bit in the presentation of our course on this. Your very good distinction, the false positives, false negatives. And yeah, I think that puts language assessment in a wider context. So I wonder if we could go on now more specifically to testing and TBLT. And what we've been looking at, we've used Long's 2015 book, Second Language Acquisition and Task-Based Language Teaching, as our main text. And he has a chapter on assessment. And he says that in syllabuses which consist of his sequence of pedagogic tasks derived from a needs analysis of target tasks, assessment should consist of task-based, criterion-referenced performance tests. So, for example, to test if a student can follow directions, instead of gap-filling or grammar tests, we give testees a recording of directions to a destination and then send them out into the street and see if they can get there. And if we can't send them out into the street, well, we ask them to watch a video and do the same thing. So that's the idea of that kind of test. And the criterion is very simple. Can they get to the destination? It's a simple pass-fail thing, rather like a driving test. So just to kick us off, what's your opinion of this idea of criterion reference performance tests?
Yeah, well, I have no problem at all with performance-based testing or criterion reference testing. And the criterion in this case is the target communicative behavior in a context in the real world. But in most of those criterion situations, we're not able to put the person in that criterion situation, just say, do it, and if you succeed, you've passed. Mainly because of health and safety issues. You couldn't do that with my previous example, an airline pilot. So you have to create tasks that they do, which are an abstraction from real life. So in the case of the map, you give someone a map and say, can they get to the other end? First of all, we assume that they're going to have to ask someone something, or there's going to be some language use involved, reading the map, understanding directions, and so on. But this doesn't take into account the task conditions. What happens if they're going to have to do this task in the real world in different weather conditions? What happens if they're communicating with different L1 or L2 speakers during the course of completing the task? The example I tend to use with students on this one is I sometimes ask them to see if they can create some tasks that they would use to choose someone as a lifeguard. And often the students say, well, just get them to swim in the sea. And I say, well, what would a lifeguard do? And they say, well, they'd pull someone out. And I say, how far into the sea would they go? How heavy is the person? If you're testing over different days, isn't it unfair on some people if there are different currents, or if the temperature is different? And this is why the tests for lifeguards take place in pools with dummies rather than large people who are splashing about all over the place, or small people who are comatose. And language tests are like this. We create abstractions from real life. And the question that we have is, are we justified in assuming that the scores that we arrive at from the performance on those tasks, can they be generalized to other similar tasks that we might create? And then can we extrapolate from those to the criterion situation? So while I have a lot of sympathy with that position, I think it's actually considerably more complex, which is why, validity theorists like Messick said that, we really still have to think about issues of constructs, about underlying abilities, and how we might get at those to achieve generalizability.
Yes, this is obviously the question of the problem of transferability of task-based abilities, which I want to come on to a little bit later. To what extent can we transfer or can we extrapolate from somebody's ability to do the task to any general ability? Can we just, though, so that we've got that. We've got, yes, in principle it's okay, but of course it's much more complex than than that first example. But let's say that in terms of the criterion reference performance, well, more in terms of the performance itself, Long says that we should ask domain experts, not language people, to decide on the criteria for pass-fail. So, for example, in a test of a student's ability to understand an undergraduate's physics lecture, the physics professor, not the language teacher or the test designer, will be the judge of what's considered successful task completion. So now we're getting a bit more into, you know, a bit more detail. Would you agree with Long on that, that it's the domain experts, not linguists or even language teachers, who should decide on the criteria?
The criteria for scoring the performance, of course, is different from the criterion performance. I'll just make that distinction. The criterion performance is the performance in the real world to which we wish to predict. The criteria for the successful performance are what we think should be evidenced in the performance on the task, and how we change that evidence into a number or letter or something that we then interpret. Now, as far as the use of domain experts is concerned, I do thoroughly agree with that. It's in the past, of course, domain experts were not consulted, but it's becoming generally they are now consulted as part of the research process of test design. And I think one of the first tests in which this was done was actually the occupational English test, which is the medical test which was developed in Australia. Tests of English for health professionals. And when they developed the scoring criteria, they came up with the linguists came up with the usual culprits, you know, things like grammatical accuracy and fluency and pronunciation and so on. And they showed this to the health professionals who were going to be training second language speakers in hospitals, and they said, "So you're not interested in communication, right?" And this came as a great shock to all the linguists. And they then said, "Well, what kind of things is it that you value?" And they built those things into the criteria, into the scoring rubrics. And I think we've done that as well more recently with service encounters, where we look at what the people who train, say, people who operate tills in supermarkets, and we say, what kind of things do you train them in? How do you train them to interact with customers? So that we can see what these are called indigenous criteria, what these indigenous criteria are. So that's part of the research process. Where I would kind of differ again to some extent is that once the domain experts say, well, we're interested in this kind of communication, in the case of service encounters, they say we want them to establish rapport. But then when we turn around to them and say, well, what do you mean by rapport? They can't really explain beyond, well, establish a good relationship. Now, it's clearly here up to the language experts, people who are discourse analysts or whatever, to record successful interactions and then say, well, what are the features of rapport? What is it we're looking for that is linguistic evidence of rapport? And that's where I think domain experts can't do what we do.
Do you mind if I just come in there? Because I had a question about the occupational English test. In your opinion, Glenn, can we regard that as a kind of task-based assessment? Because I'm just looking at, for example, they have different versions for different professions within the health sector. There's one for optometrists. In fact, in front of me right now, the task is dealing with a patient who's got cement dust in their eye. Is that the kind of thing that we can regard as a task-based assessment according to Long's criteria?
Yes, clearly.
And in your opinion, is it a robust assessment? Because we know that up until now, for example, for people to come to the UK to work in the NHS, they've had to get a certain score on the IELTS scale. I would imagine you would agree that this is infinitely preferable a way to assess people's English competence when coming to work in a sector like health.
In this case, I'm much closer. The real question here is the purpose of the test. And in many cases, test designers fail to define the purpose of the test. And the purpose includes who is going to be taking the test, what is the criterion domain, in other words, what kind of predictions do we wish to make from the scores about whose ability to perform under what conditions in what context? Now, the IELTS example is a very good one because that was designed as a test of academic English to decide whether potential students would be able to perform adequately during the first few months at university, an English medium university. But the temptation, of course, is to use the scores for other purposes. And IELTS is used for deciding about whether nurses can work in hospitals. And then you have to go to the test and say, well, in this case, the obvious example is the content aspect of construct-related validity. And you look at the test and you say, is there anything in here that resembles what nurses would do in the criterion domain? And for me, the answer to that is patently no. Whereas the occupational English test is specifically designed for health professionals. And as you pointed out, it's it's not just a generic health professional test, but there are modules for specific fields. The question is how, well, this has been asked for a long time. How specific is specific? Mm. You can keep on drilling down into criterion areas to the extent where the test just becomes non-viable because it costs more to develop than you would ever recoup from the number of people taking the test. But equally, if you don't represent the constructs that are required to perform in the target domain, it becomes very difficult to say that the decisions you are making are sound.
Okay, so we agree that domain experts should be involved in deciding the criteria for these tests. But as you say, Glenn, if the domain expert says, well, this candidate must show empathy, we ask, what do you mean by that? Probably we need a linguistics expert to define what that means in linguistic terms and to some extent say what how we recognize it. And this, I think, goes on to the question of, in tasks that require spoken or written production, Long says that the focus remains on the task completion with measurable behavioral outcomes. So if you say the task is to phone somebody and make an appointment and arrange something. If they do it, they do it. But in spoken or written production, the question is, what about the language used? Should the language itself be judged? And if so, what are the criteria for that? So I think it follows on from your reply to the question of the domain expert. When we look at tasks that require spoken or written production, if there should be some measurement of the language used to perform the task, how should that language be judged?
Well, I would say this very much depends on the analysis of the language that an expert or a successful communicator in those contexts would use. And this may vary depending on the context. Now, one example, going back to the example of aviation English, the language of aviation English is very is standardized, and we know a lot about that. But we might want to find out whether or not, say, pilots could deal with unusual or unforeseen circumstances that would require them to use language outside of standard phraseology. And so we would say, well, if they need linguistic flexibility, what are the kinds of situations they might face and what kind of language would they need to be able to deal with those? And going back to the issue of domain experts, we could actually talk to domain experts and say, can we start defining that range of situations and then saying what kind of language would be required? And we would build those, build that language into rating scales. If it's the performance assessment, so that we could make judgments, or human raters could make judgments about whether or not the performance evidences language and linguistic features that we think would allow the test takers to perform successfully beyond, if necessary, the kinds of tasks that they encounter in the test. This again is the issue of generalizability, because in a test we can only give them a very limited number of tasks, but the tasks that they may face in the criterion situation are very large. So with the linguistic features, we do have more chance of achieving generalizability than we would by just saying, oh, they successfully completed this task, because that is something which we can't generalize.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, so there would, in other words, it wouldn't be, in lots of situations, it wouldn't be pass-fail.
I think that's the case, because if someone just does one or two performance tasks, because on tests, performance tasks actually take quite a long time. So that's why most tests only have a few.
Yeah. Right?
So the question is, have we adequately sampled from the target domain?
Right.
And the answer to that question is usually, no, we haven't, because the test just isn't long enough. So if we say, well, they have successfully completed this task, the only statement we can make about the future is they are likely to complete tasks like the one they completed on the test.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this brings us on to probably the most, the biggest sort of question of all, is precisely the problem of transferability of task-based abilities. To what extent can their ability to perform a task we give them predict their ability, their general performance ability. And that, of course, leads to the argument that surely it's better to test command of the constructs and abilities that underlie task performance with attention to linguistic abilities. So, in other words, surely proficiency tests like IELTS and TOEFL and the rest of Cambridge suites, aren't they a better way of testing?
Well, so you're going to be surprised by this answer, and because I'm going to say no, actually.
Well, I'm very glad to hear you say that.
And I think the reason for that comes back to this issue of test purpose.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as a test which is inherently better than another test. You've got to say, well, what is the purpose of this test? And if we take TOEFL, for example, of course, all of the research that went into developing the TOEFL IBT was about looking at the kinds of situations that second language speaking students find themselves in North American universities. And so when you look at the limited performance tasks that you get, say, on the speaking, one of them will be taking part in some kind of academic seminar or talking to a tutor. And the other one might be interacting with a service provider, like doing something in the library or booking a room in a university hall of residence or something like that. And the research that all of the selection of these tasks was based on was going into universities, looking at what people did, but also recording interactions. And of course, that was done, lots of that research was done by Douglas Biber. And then there was corpus-based research.
Yes.
Saying what kind of language is used to achieve those. So it was a mix of looking at representative tasks, or tasks that are as representative as we can make them, given that all testing is an abstraction, and the study of the language used to achieve those tasks, which informed also the scoring criteria. And this is why testing is a research enterprise. But it was all driven by the statement of test purpose. So is TOEFL a good test, you ask? Well, it's a good test for the purpose it was designed for, given the limitations of time and the fact that it is an abstraction. If you were then to say to me, well, because it tests linguistic features, which it does that make it a good test for nurses? The answer is no.
Right. The problem then really is, can we get a handle on the constructs and abilities that underlie a particular task? Is there any way that we can, map task performance with underlying linguistic abilities that could be tested in the way that TOEFL and Cambridge tend to do it? Or is there a complete divide between the two?
No, I think that attempting to define the constructs that make the performance on a particular task possible is a fundamental part of establishing the validity of the meaning of the scores that are generated by the performance.
Yes, yes. But how do we do it, Gary? Can we get a handle on them?
Yeah. Okay. So let's take a specific example, I guess. So, in fact, I will use one that we've already mentioned. I gave the example in service encounters of domain experts saying what they want is an ability to establish rapport. Okay? Now, rapport is a construct.
Right.
And we know what constructs are because they are abstract nouns that define, that describe a communicative ability, and we all think we know what it means. Although if we were asked to describe what evidence we would need for rapport, we would probably struggle to do it.
Yeah.
So we collect lots of examples of people successfully communicating in the criterion domain, and then we start looking at what they do to achieve what we think is rapport.
Right.
And in this case, we find things like an ability to manage turn-taking without interrupting the customer, because we've got a power imbalance. So we start looking at individuals who communicate well, where one person, in this case a customer, has more power than the service provider. And how do they manage the turn-taking in those contexts?
Right.
How does the service provider make the customer feel that they're paying attention to them? And one thing that, going back to the work of Halliday and Hassan, indeed, you know, they were looking at side sequencing. So, you know, it's not something that is often taught if you're teaching language to people who are going to be working in shops. But, you know, if you're, you know, the one for people who are British, of course, is the weather. You know, if I'm at a supermarket counter, they don't just talk about the food. They say, oh, it's a nice day today, isn't it? And if I respond appropriately, then they'll say, are you doing anything later on, or have you finished work? Right?
Yeah.
And how is that managed? How do they know when to do it? What are the linguistic features we look for? People pausing. How long do you pause before you speak again if you're managing a side sequence? Now, all of these things are the linguistic aspects,
yes,
of rapport, and we can describe how they work at the level of discourse, and we can describe how they work at the level of grammar and lexis.
Yeah.
So I think it's quite possible to do this, but where the insights from task based approaches are really, really important is that the tasks helped to define the communicative domain.
Yeah.
And in the past, people who, language testers who just said, okay, so let's just test grammar. Well, grammar for what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why tasks and understanding tasks and content is so important, because otherwise the scores are meaningless. And I'll just give you one other historical reference here, which I think is really, really great. And that's, you probably know it actually, Walter Colfers, who was a language tester working during the Second World War.
No, I'm afraid I don't.
You don't? Okay. Well, they were teaching soldiers the language they would need once they, American soldiers, when they arrived in Europe. So they were teaching German and French and so on. And the only tests they had to decide whether these soldiers were ready or not were tests of grammar. And Colfers wrote a wonderful paper in 1944 in which he said, we need task-based performance tests for these people, because tests of grammar alone cannot tell us whether or not they will be able to communicate to in situations where otherwise life and limb would be at risk.
All right, so let's say, for example, I don't know, let's just take the Cambridge suite of tests where interview is included. Does that have any sort of general value in your opinion? I'm sure it does have some value, but how much value would you give a test like that?
Well, in the Cambridge suite, I would hope that no one was making... I would hope that they weren't high stakes and that no one was making really, really important decisions on the basis of the scores. Because for the most part, they're used in general language education. Now, let's say I'm, you know, all over the world, there are classes which are just, you know, people are going to learn English. They're not going to learn it for any particular purpose. They're going to learn English. And people learn English in schools, right?
Right.
And what it seems to me Cambridge are doing is quite legitimate here. They're saying, hey, these are tests and we have to base them on something. So we base them on things like, threshold or, you know, some kind of syllabus that someone's worked out. Maybe linked to course books, and they say, hey, these are useful in general education to motivate students, because we know that tests do motivate people. And, some of my favorite older quotes are about, was it Henry Latham in 1887, and he wrote, I think I quote this in the book you mentioned at the beginning.
Yeah, of course,
you know,
yeah.
He said students learn more when they know the day of reckoning is at hand.
Exactly.
all right. They're motivators.
Yes, of course.
Students like taking these, and they hopefully they get a decent grade, and their parents are proud, and but you're not making serious decisions.
So you don't think, for example, that sticking with Cambridge assessment, FCE, what's the next one? Cambridge First Certificate, Cambridge Advanced, Cambridge Proficiency. Of course, these are all linked to the CEFR scale in the end, which we'll talk about in a minute, I hope. But anyway, you don't think that these are terribly good indications. If I say to you, or someone were to say to you, I've passed the Cambridge Advanced Certificate, that gives any particularly useful advice about one's proficiency in English?
No, I don't think I said that. I think that if someone is learning English in a school environment and they're not learning it for a particular purpose, they're just learning English, then these assessments give a general indication of someone's ability to communicate in English.
Mm-hmm.
But would I employ someone with FCE as a locum GP? No. Would I employ them as a pilot? No.
Right.
And I can go on.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm afraid to say in Spain, these tests are often used in some companies to determine whether somebody can be promoted or not. And at university, you can't finish an undergraduate degree without passing advanced. I think they give you a few years after you finish the degree to do it, but you don't award a degree until you've actually demonstrated that you can, well, that you've passed the CAE.
Mm. Well, I would simply ask the question, why?
Yeah.
I mean, what's the rationale for that? I mean, I would,
Hoop jumping.
It's possible that there may be one, but I can't see it immediately.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think, can we just go on from this? It does seem to me important to point out the limitations of the kind of high, you know, these tests that have enormous repercussions on particularly young people's professional, you know, possibilities. Tests like TOEFL, IATA, and the Cambridge Suites are in fact used, and you, I know, Glenn, are completely good, but I mean, they are used to make incredibly important decisions about...
Yes, they are.
People's lives.
Yeah.
Which it's extraordinary, you know, given what it is that they're testing. And as you say, you can't extrapolate from, oh, I've got a Cambridge First Certificate, to very much about your ability to do any particular job.
Well, I think that's right. And I think the only thing we can say here is that there is a difference between what policy makers think tests can do, yeah, and what language testers think tests can do. And policy makers will use language tests as surrogates for other things. So right, we know, for example, that IELTS and TOEFL and the Pearson tests are used by politicians in some countries to make immigration decisions.
Yes.
And they like that because those tests have been mapped onto the CFR. And as far as I'm concerned, that's all smoke and mirrors anyway. But we have put in their hands a tool that allows them to make policy decisions without any fear of them being accused of racism or anything like that. And yeah, they will use CFR levels and associated tests to implement policy decisions which language testers or educators may not approve of. We occupy, I'm afraid, virtually different universes, and whether or not we are complicit in some of what I consider unethical uses is one of the big policy and political debates around language testing.
Yes, yes, and we know where you stand on that. In the context of our TBLT course, I would like to ask Glenn, how would you recommend teachers who are attracted to TBLT to carry out assessment?
In actual fact, it's a very, very good place to start, because the essential thing is you look at the domain for which in which your students are going to need to communicate.
Yeah.
And you look at the tasks that they do and you say, what are the communication features of those tasks? What is the language used? And then you try to describe the range of tasks and the conditions under which they're performed. Then you say, okay, what's the language they're going to need? Now, if they're constructing a test or an assessment, then you say, what's the data I would need to see from my students to decide whether or not they could perform in the domain?
Right.
And then you have all of the basis for creating an assessment, which you can use locally in your institution or in your classrooms.
Great. Glenn, thank you so much. It was marvellous to talk to you. We'll be in touch, but thank you very much indeed.
Right, no problems. You're welcome. And I will email you. I'm starting to lose my voice now. It's because I'm not talking very much working from home. I'll email you that Colfer's paper.
Great.
And then when this is ready and you upload it, you can put the Colfer's paper next to it.
All right. Hey, Glenn, you take care. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, you too. Stay safe, huh?
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Stay safe. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.